Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Science, Technology, and Society channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Nupur. Today, I'm speaking to Professor Rahul Mukherjee, who is a Dick Wolf Associate Professor of New Television and New Media Studies and an Associate Professor of English at the University of Pennsylvania. Today, we will be discussing his first book titled Radiant Infrastructures, Media, Environment, and Cultures of Uncertainty, published by Duke University Press, that looks at mediations of debates / controversies related to radiation-emitting technologies such as cell antennas and nuclear reactors. Situated at the intersection of science studies and television and new media studies, Rahul has written extensively on database management systems, advertising cultures of mobile telephony, Bollywood thrillers, chronic toxicity related to chemical disasters, development discourses, and translocal documentaries, among other things. Welcome, Rahul. So thrilled to be in conversation with you today.
Thanks, Nupur, for that generous introduction, and I'm very much looking forward to discussing the book with you.
We're going to focus on your book, Radiant Infrastructures, today. If I may try to summarize, the book explores the process of mediation, as well as the role of various media assemblages, from talk shows to documentary films, to biomedical imaging techniques in generating and sustaining different types of public discourses, as well as different publics, around namely two radiant infrastructures, cell tower antennas and nuclear reactors. You talk about contestations around their legitimacy, the corporeal and affective charges that these bio-info material infrastructures produce, as well as importantly, the various public interest movements that mobilize to support or oppose their assembling. I really enjoyed reading the book, and especially within our contemporary moment, where questions of misinformation and disinformation, as well as anxieties around science and scientific expertise, have gained ground, the book is particularly generative for how it foregrounds what you call public cultures of uncertainty. To start us off, can you please tell us a bit about yourself, your academic journey, and your primary research areas of interest?
Yeah, thanks, Nupur. That's a very helpful summary of the book. I was a BTech student in India. I also worked in the software industry in India for a while. I was also in a design sort of usability firm for some time, and then decided to work or like study more in communication studies and film and media studies. And while I was a BTech student, I got very interested in the humanities. And by the time I arrived to do film and media studies in University of California, Santa Barbara, I realized that there was a lot of writing that was going on media technologies and on media infrastructures. So I got interested in that. So in a way, when I was studying at kind of software engineering and information communication technology, I gravitated towards the humanities. And by the time I reached a humanities network, sort of humanities school, I got really interested in then media technology. So I ended up kind of developing some kind of like a hybrid way of studying technologies from a humanities and social science perspective over time.
I just have to say that the previous episode that I did was with Sandeep Merthia about Lives of Data. And it was really interesting because we, in fact, started our discussion by talking about, I think, the same BTEC program that y'all went to. And we're like just broadly talking about how science studies has a different trajectory in India, right? Like even as a field formation.
It has a different trajectory. You know, the Center for the Study of Developing Societies had a whole bunch of scholars who sort of really very influential in thinking mm-hmm. about alternative sciences, particularly in the Indian context, at various points mm-hmm. of time, whether it's Ashish Nandi, Shiv Viswanathan, Mandana Shiva, and others.
So getting to the book, what is the origin story of this book? How did you conceive of this book? And yeah, just like, why do you think of studying these two particular kinds of infrastructures?
Yeah, I must admit that sort of to begin with, I was very interested in studying environmental controversies or health related controversies to begin with. And I really initially was very interested in studying partly the media mobilizations around the International Coalition for Justice in Bhopal, around the continuing aftermath of the Bhopal gas disaster. Mm. And that was kind of formative to how I was thinking across, you know, STS as well as media studies. And so while I was writing my dissertation, I had a number of chapters around this issue of environmental controversy and publics. And so you, as you mentioned in the book also, there is that sort of continuing gesture to trying to understand the kinds of publics that gather around particular environmental or health-related controversies. And that was what I was studying initially, certainly media's role in such controversies and formation of those kinds of publics. So I had like four different case studies in my dissertation, some related to the work of the International Coalition for Justice in Bhopal, some related to the BD Brinjal controversy, which led to a number of public hearings, as you remember. And then there were two of these case studies, one with cell antenna related debates and another around nuclear reactors. And then you know, I'd written individually some articles about the BD Brinjal in Bhopal and sort of then really decided to focus on nuclear reactors and cell towers for the book. And part of the reason simply was that when I was doing my field work, as I say in the first two pages of my introduction, I did find those two controversies being discussed quite a bit, whether it was at the, you know, the down-to-earth environmental magazine in Delhi, offices there, or in other places, I just found them being discussed. So I just ended up writing about them together. Yeah.
No, that's fascinating. And I could really relate to it, not because I'd followed these two in particular, but it was also making me think about other food science and mm-hmm. nutrition related controversies, mm-hmm. which I think growing up again in the 90s, 2000s in a particular televisual culture, mm-hmm. I think I'd heard and felt a lot, you know, just about food contamination and how popular and I guess popular shows have captured the imagination, right, around like colored food powder and all these like different anxieties around food science.
So. Yeah, maybe even Maggi noodles was
Absolutely. So because our audiences might not be entirely familiar with the context that we're talking about, mm-hmm. Can you briefly contextualize the development or the emergence of cell towers and nuclear reactors within the history of technoscience in India? And just what kind of imaginaries do they emerge as? And what visions of modernity and national development do they get folded in?
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah. So, I mean, they're very different infrastructures and in many ways. It's important to mention them in the sense that, you know, talking about even radiation, nuclear reactors emit ionizing radiation, cell towers emit non-ionizing radiation, more in sort of the radio energies part of the spectrum. And the historical context for both of them is also very different. Nuclear reactors beginning with India's independence, there's been this long narrative of energy sufficiency, where nuclear reactors have played a big role. Atomic tests, which are not that separate from nuclear reactors in some sense in India as well as in other parts of the world, have played an important role. And and they've been always associated with, you know, a kind of energy self-sufficiency, electrification drives in India. So that's one kind of narrative around nuclear reactors. And the cell towers discussion about mobile phones, that's been much more in the sort of decade of the 90s associated very much with neoliberalization, with a certain kind of savviness about technologies, has had a different discourse. But there too, you see ideas of ubiquitous connectivity as a kind of future. More recently, you know, other kinds of visions of digital India being part of mobile phones. So it's certainly both of them have had a very different trajectory. Maybe just one more point, that if you think about political economy, nuclear reactors have had over a long time in India a much more sort of public sector understanding of it, very, very state regulated, because it's a strategic resource, so on and so forth, nuclear fuel, so on and so forth. And with cellular technology, there's been always a move towards more and more privatization.
Interesting. Could you tell us a bit about how the book is structured and the scope of the themes and topics that you address through the five chapters?
Yeah, so I have like a separate chapter each on, to begin with, one on cell towers, another one on nuclear reactors, where I'm trying to think in each of these separate chapters, just charting through the controversies and debates that were part of it, particularly looking at how these were covered in different kinds of media and a range of different media forms, from documentary films to lifestyle shows, from cartoons to local newspapers. So quite a variety of how a different sets of stakeholders affected by this, by these environmental debates, got together and, you know, painted a particular kind of picture about these radiant infrastructures on media and through different media channels, trying to mobilize the publics in different sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. So the first two chapters separately, one on cell towers, then another one on nuclear reactors. And then I tried to sort of really think about, in the next two chapters, that is 3 and 4, something more particular about the kind of technical properties of radiant infrastructures, like emissions and exposures, but they also are also about how some of these infrastructures are governed. So, you know, people who govern nuclear reactors don't want to talk about information leakage about nuclear waste leakage. Mm-hmm. Or similarly, the telecom authorities also want to regulate emissions, but at the same time also regulate information about the emissions. And sometimes it's just not possible to do that because these infrastructures are also very diffusive. And then exposures also is very much about sort of bodily exposure to these infrastructures, to the radiations emitted by these infrastructures. And so those two chapters, more on sort of properties, but also how the governance of such infrastructures happens, emissions and exposures. And then the final chapter is kind of titled Styling Advocacy, which is more around how activism around these two radiant infrastructures happens, how they're somewhat different, why they're different, why a group of anti-nuclear activists sort of draw more from India's people's movements around protests related to dams or other kinds of like protests, including the Bhopal gas disaster, while a different sort of activism happens, much more related to sometimes maybe a NIMBYism, sometimes related to maybe the more urban bourgeois movements in cities of India, that the kind of cell tower eviction drives kind of took from. So yeah, two very different kinds of movements, and I got very interested in that. So I had a chapter which sort of tried to compare the two.
Hmm. Again, just for our audiences to follow along, if you could, in sort of one or two lines, tell us what the fear or the controversy around cell towers was, as well as nuclear reactors was.
Yeah, I mean, in both cases, right, like there is this, there are debates about the siting of nuclear reactors or the siting of cell towers. Now, because they are very different kinds of infrastructures, the proximity as to how far the nuclear reactor should be is very different from the proximity mm-hmm. of a cell antenna, which could be in the rooftop of an apartment, right? And one is living next to it in a densely sort of populated urban center. So mm-hmm. questions of proximity about how close they should be or how close for comfort they can be was one of the matters. In some cases with nuclear reactors, there was some displacement. In the nuclear reactor case, particularly fissure persons who were affected, say in Kudankulam, which is one of the more famous cases mm-hmm. of where a nuclear reactor was being established. The fishing community there criticized or perceived the nuclear reactors as leading to contaminating or raising the temperatures of the seawater coming in or the ocean water coming in, which led to them saying that, you know, their fish yields would decrease if the nuclear reactor was set up. In the case of cell towers, people found cases of cancer, which they sort of wanted to correlate or show as like causal effects, which was a difficult thing to show per se, but the perception never left that maybe the cancer was caused because of a cell tower nearby, because people would come out of into their verandas or balconies and see a cellular structure there, and they got afraid. So, and then it was amplified through different, you know, lifestyle shows and talk shows, which led people to worry more and more, particularly in urban centers, with respect to the cell tower controversy.
Okay. Coming to the concepts in the book, I love that the book's focus is on mediation processes, intermediality, infrastructuring, and the waxing and waning of publics that converge and diverge around issues. To begin with, can you unpack the title of the book, as well as the concept of radiant infrastructures for us?
Yeah. I mean, you know, because I was writing about both these two infrastructures, initially, radiant infrastructures mostly was a kind of descriptive term, or almost like, oh, they were like, could stand in for this. But then I started thinking about kind of conceptualizing it. And there you found like both this aspect of radiance that's often associated in a metaphoric sense with a lot of infrastructures, whether it's, you know, roads, railways, as kind of symbolic or epitomizing modernity, right? And then, then I got interested in the kind of more radiation-specific aspects of these infrastructures, like the actual radiation emission from nuclear reactors, from cell towers, which in a way differentiated them from other infrastructures, and that also then led me to think that there is this side of illumination, of electrification, of ubiquitous connectivity. But there is also the side of radiance associated with possibilities of cancer, possibilities of toxicity, which sort of formed a kind of shadow around the kind of illuminating aspects. And then one could think about the electromagnetic spectrum, think about spectrality. And so, yeah, sort of was one side of light illumination and the other side of more, you know, the spectrum, the shadow. So both kind of constituted together this idea of radiance.
Hmm. It did make me, I don't think you've discussed it in the book explicitly, but it also made me think about how there's an emergent narrative around solar infrastructures, right, which has gained a lot of attention, I think, in the recent maybe decade or so, again, about like using, I mean, of course, the sun has a special place in the Hindu cultural traditions, etc., and then fitting into India's also versions of like techno modernity, etc., and how I felt like solar infrastructures are also now being marketed in some ways as these radiant infrastructures, but perhaps without the carcinogenic shadow of them.
No, that's a great point. And you know, like, I'm just thinking about that special issue of the South Atlantic Quarterly on solarity. There were some remarkable essays and around questions of radiance associated with sunlight, and all this talk about energy transformation moving towards solar energy as a big step. And I think that's, solar infrastructures would certainly be very much a part of radiant infrastructures conceptualization. And I think that's where I really want to think further with this concept. And I think there were pieces by Nicole Staroselsky talking about how when you're even thinking about sunlight, you have to sort of think beyond visible sunlight and think about the other parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. Excessive heat can also be damaging. So there are some of those aspects too. And it's also fascinating, right? This other piece by Nandita Badami on how that promise of electricity and light from solar energy does not just remain about light, but then this light is also said to, be helpful in educating people so that they can have more study hours, or this is going to lead to much more socioeconomic benefits. So the connotations of radiance here, of connotations of electrification and light go much beyond, and connotations of sunlight go much beyond just electrification. So I think these are fascinating avenues for more research and thinking with radiant infrastructures. Yeah, I'm learning a lot from some of this new work on solar energy. So thanks for mentioning that. Yeah.
No, I've been thinking about it for a bit, because I also feel like there is a certain racial or even, I guess, national valence to thinking about, especially solar energies, although this is tangential, because I feel like, this is really just anecdotal, but coming from India, and the ways in which we've been taught to think of certain energies as positive, as life-giving, as vital, versus, for example, interacting with European or North American colleagues about also how they, for all kinds of true reasons, fear overexposure to sunlight, right, just in their bodies, is a very interesting difference for me to just think with.
And that's something much more culture specific and something that needs to be thought through more. That's a great point, Nupur.
To come back to your book and dwelling a little bit more on infrastructure, infrastructure is a favorite for science and media studies scholars and others as well. And you spend some time fleshing out the infrastructural function as well as what and how radiance does to how we understand infrastructuring. Would you mind situating the book as an intervention within, like, sort of the various definitions and conceptualizations of infrastructure that exist?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of writing in critical infrastructure studies and within STS and media studies, certainly, and also certainly anthropology. I think one of the things that I was thinking the one crucial point I can think about amongst other points would be that with radiant infrastructures, because they're so diffusive because of these emissions, that it's difficult to sort of think about their scale or think about their structure within their somewhat tangible structures, right? In the sense that a cell antenna occupies a certain space on some apartment's rooftop. A nuclear reactor occupies a certain space in almost like a factory kind of setting, so on and so forth. But the kinds of emissions they produce, the leakages that happen, and the way they spread, that kind of spread is so much more diffusive, so much more atmospheric, mm-hmm. That it's difficult to sort of, I think, in a way, think about them as just these tangible structures. But rather, if one has to, in a way, think about them both conceptually and empirically, then one would have to really think about them more in this kind of diffusive sense, more mm-hmm. in this kind of atmospheric sense. So you cannot just stop at the kind of tangible portion of that infrastructure mm-hmm. when you're, you know, doing anything, planning a policy around them.
Of course. And the other concept that you offer related to or emerging from mm-hmm. gradient infrastructures is that of environmental publics,
right,
that congregate around the concerns of radiation and contamination. And you distinguish between the urban bourgeois publics that are affected by the cell towers being, you know, on their roofs or in close proximity, and they fear them. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, the rural and indigenous communities, fisher persons and farmers, that come together to protest the construction of nuclear reactors. So what is the relationship of radiant infrastructures to these corresponding environmental publics?
In the sense that so environmental publics is a term which I'm using for kind of both thinking of these different stakeholders who come together around a debate or controversy around one of these infrastructures. How do they gather? What causes them to gather together? What causes maybe internal frictions within different stakeholders because they're impacted differently or they shape the controversy in a different way? What role does media play in both gathering them in a, you know, TV talk show or mm-hmm. Or on a news program, or when they're at a tea stall discussing about this. So environmental publics kind of play that role. Now, I had to sort of, as I was doing it, it was also partly kind of a research approach too, where I would identify the different, stakeholders may not be the word which always is able captures. To capture that. But yeah, maybe yeah. the another word could be affected communities. And the idea was to talk to different sets of groups of people who were affected by these debates or who were participating in these debates for what reasons. So it became also a kind of research method in a way to go around and talk to people. So in both senses, it was a way to write about these infrastructures. And it was also a way to do research.
So I was curious about something that you wrote in relation to environment publics, mm-hmm. Which is that you really carefully sort of flesh out how, I think it's a Dewey articulation of issue-based publics, right? So people come together around certain issues. But then you also emphasize how certain events or issues may bring people together, but it's not necessarily that they may stay together or keep talking about these things, right? So they may, the interest may sort of wane, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And also the fact that, the core notion where I was wondering is that what exactly happens when people are, because I'm thinking more about how there is an increasing tendency, for all the right reasons to map class, caste, gender, race, etc., mm-hmm. in terms of how people arrive or care about certain topics, right? But in this case, it's not as if the urban publics, for example, are in any ways cohesive or brought together by any of those positionalities in a straightforward manner. But they all come together, perhaps, if I'm not wrong, mm-hmm. but, due to their fear or apprehensions about these infrastructures. And then they engage in a series of things that happen. And then would you say that they come out or emerge as transformed or at least bound together by a certain common understanding of science or modernity or something else?
To some extent, yes. But one of the points that I think, a kind of conversation around John Dewey and his impact on how Publix has been studied within STS is this notion of how the impact of a certain infrastructure leads or a technology leads a public to form, to sort of work through those effects. But what I also found was that could be one part of the one part of studying that, but the other part was also about the kind of organizational capabilities and organizational structures, which also led to particular kinds of publics developing given different contexts. So in a way, that was what I was trying to study in the fifth chapter of my book around, when I mentioned the styling advocacy, which was a kind of comparative study of these two different movements and the kind of protest tactics used by the fishing community in southern Tamil Nadu was very different from the kind of, label of concerned citizens or a kind of one way of thinking about the civil society movements in the kind of urban centers like Mumbai or Bombay in the case of the cell tower debate. So in a way, if we are to think about publics and public cultures, we cannot just think them around technology and its effects. We'll have to also think about sort of organizing cultures of public discourse and public mobilization.
Absolutely. The chapter four is titled Exposure. And in chapter three, as you foreshadow chapter four, you leave us with this question, which is, how can human bodies be considered a part of environmental publics? If bodies and radiant technologies are coextensive, how do embodied sensitivities to radiation make us think of the body as constituting a kind of media in an intermedial circuit with other media forms? Within the various registers of knowledge and sense-making about what could be construed as highly technical phenomena, right? Cell towers and nuclear reactors. As you show in the chapter, there's also obviously deep embodiment. There's proximity and intimacy, and consequently paranoid and contaminated corporeal affect, like feelings of disease and perhaps forthcoming sickness. Can you talk more about the role of the body as media and what it the role it plays in arriving in people arriving at personal judgments on radiant infrastructures while the science is still being arbitrated?
Thanks. I mean, that's a crucial point, both for the whole book and particularly in chapter four, because I'm looking and thinking about bodily exposures and questions of proximity and intimacy, and in many cases, what Kath Weston calls unwanted intimacies with these radiations. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in a way, to put it perhaps in a more simplified way, I would say something that the body is as media is one way to sort of formulate this, partly just because body is a sense-making, is also a sensor at some level. But at the same time, the body is also, there are some aspects of radiation, both ionizing and non-ionizing, where which evades bodily senses, certainly the human bodily senses in certain ways, right? And so then the body gets intermediately connected to the giga counter or the dosimeter or the radiation detector as a way to understand from or translate some of these radiation measurements for getting a sense of what's happening. There's also with nuclear radiation and the kind of genetic mutations that happen sometimes close, sometimes fast, in the way they rapidly transform the body depending upon the exposure amounts, there's a sense of kind of a lack of bodily control, that things are out of grasp, and that leads to all kinds of bodily sensitizations and sensitivities. Of course, each human body is is different. So that makes standardization very different. And I mean, you know, in particular media objects, standardization is key. But how does one standardize a human body? That's not quite possible. So that's a big difference from, you know, a kind of standardized media tool, right? So, I mean, one can think about the human body as media, as part of intermedial circuits of sense-making practices. But at the same time, differences also need to be mentioned. And the question of sensitivity is kind of key, and this aspect of how each human body responds differently to radiation is also key. And one of those sort of dominant models of thinking about, say, non-ionizing electromagnetic radiation from cell towers, Wi-Fi, and other such infrastructures has been to think that there are these interferences that happen between signals inside the body and signals outside the body. So there are these aspects of interference which also make you think that that as one is thinking about radiant infrastructures, that one has to think of them beyond tangible bodies and tangible media objects, but again, think of them at the level of the signal or at the signaletic vis-a-vis the mediatic, or the signaletic being part of the mediatic. Absolutely. I don't know.
Fair. To follow along the stories of both the cell towers and nuclear reactors, and what you just said about, you know, in this case, bodies as media, but also perhaps actively sensing media, right? Because there's something happening here. Like, people are also collecting or paying attention to their corporeal and otherwise experiences and gathering this knowledge, and then also finding ways to test and prove that this knowledge isn't just like something that they feel or, you know, or their imagination, so to speak. Can you give us just examples or tell us, like, how did this play out? What would happen? Because people would sense that either a tower was being assembled in proximity or was already there, or in other cases, for example, you talk about uranium mining and then, you know, people struggling to sort of establish that this is really happening. So what would happen?
Say that again, Nupur, like, what would happen in the sense of?
In the sense of, like, say, for example, one of the things you talk about is that this man saw a cell phone tower being assembled, or it was already assembled, and then there would be a certain feeling. There would also be cases or, you know, talk about how somebody's got cancer. And then from there, it would go all the way to, it would go in several directions. There was already a layer of television shows and other popular media around it, but also at the level of citizen advocacy, right? So people would come together and make representations for why this tower should be removed. So how did people go from feeling something in their body or talking at home or talking amongst friends about these things to making a stronger case for, you know, how this thing is a real scientific thing that they're talking about, and sort of mounting a counter case to say this should be removed?
That's a great question. I mean at times it would be more like kind of a momentary feeling of seeing a cell tower. At other times people would not even notice, and sometimes you would hear some of these testimonies mentioning that there was one point of time when it finally dawned on them in a way that they noticed a cell tower, and also noticed that maybe that could have been the reason why somebody's child was ill because of the proximity of it. So sometimes it was not just about noticing that the tower was there, but more like noticing that, well, there is this tower, and this could be the cause for something bad that's happening to my child. Different points of making that connection were critical. Then, of course, I think the TV reports but also some kind of civil society ways of organizing and talking about it. Some of the rooftop meetings where in apartments where they would hold these meetings, where both the cellular tower groups would come talking about that they didn't feel that any of this radiation was that harmful. And then some of the more sort of anti-cell tower activists or concerned citizens would arrive using a microwave oven that see the microwave oven also makes this radiation detector move from green to red light. And so does the same thing happen when somebody was calling another cell phone. So they would sort of make these ways of, in their own ways, kind of making visible radiation. And I mean, I think all that discourse over time certainly made it possible for people to think of cell towers as a possible threat and ask more questions in some cases, and other cases when some of these cell towers were really close to their houses, to possibly move to the court with some kind of a case, or at least regulating cell towers. It still remains debatable, of course, in terms of the medical aspects of whether cell tower radiation is harmful or not. But in many cases, it was about just a colossal number of towers being at one place. And I think that by itself, the conspicuous aspect of that made people really worried that they were being very little regulation. Or even when there was regulation in terms of emission levels, that they were not being enforced properly.
Another concept that you offer in the book is called public cultures of uncertainty. And uncertainty is sort of one of the central themes in the book as well.
Right.
And at some point you state that cultures of uncertainty are also influenced by cultures of trust, where you're talking about the role of Rajasthan Patrika, the vernacular newspaper, which is not only merely reporting on the administration's narrative of an event, but also rather sort of proudly proclaiming to serve the public or attending to the community version of the same event, perhaps. So could you first unpack what this public cultures of uncertainty means in the context of this book?
Yeah. So of course, in the kind of classic sort of STS literature, the difference between risk and uncertainty is kind of key. That risk, this is a simplified version for the sake of comparison, but say risk is much more about, has a certain kind of calculative logic. Uncertainty makes one think beyond that. There's of course a lot of work, say by Michel Calon, by Brian Wynn, by Michelle Murphy and others on this. So uncertainty certainly allowed for maybe thinking beyond the calculative logic of risk, as I was listening to how common people in their everyday lives thought of some of these radiant infrastructures as benign or harmful, and how they determined that to be the case. So I wasn't so much as in my book trying to say this is harmful or this is not harmful, but more like trying to understand how people made that determination for themselves. So there, I think uncertainty allowed for that sort of more open-ended approach to thinking through some of these anecdotes and testimonies. And there was there are two sides to this, of course, right? Like, so one side is that that over time there has been a certain kind of what many scholars have called a kind of deflation of expertise, right? With so much media coverage, with so much a lot of people having many different contrarian opinions, one doesn't really know which experts to believe in. And within the cell tower radiation controversy also, there's a sort of lack of consensus within the expert community itself, right? So so they would have their own determinations. So in that sense, there's both a deflation of expertise. There is some amount of uncertainty within the expertise community also. So that overall leads to also a lot of anecdotal evidence being discussed at the same time as experts criticize anecdotal evidence for suggesting, you know, that this is just a story and it can't be made into an evidence, or it doesn't count as scientific evidence. So So yeah, uncertainty makes its way through many aspects, but it's also important to understand that it's not just people's groups who are causing uncertainty, but that big powerful corporate lobbies also are part of creating uncertainty through funding research, which goes on to suggest that such and such a thing is not harmful, vis-a-vis some research which says such and such a thing is harmful, and which leads to a situation where one cannot definitely say one way or the other. And this is something that Michelle Murphy has written about in relation to SIG building building syndrome, and of course multiple chemical sensitivity MCS cases as well. So it's kind of like thought uncertainty, as much as it's thought of in relation to misinformation, media related, at the same time, it could also be, backed by the state and corporate players as well. So it kind of works both ways in that sense.
No, absolutely. I think at some point in the book, again, taking the example of the same newspaper, you talk about a journalist who sort of wrote one version of the story, which was about the environmental impact of a certain event. And then I think she said that she felt disempowered because the same news publication ran sort of, I guess, an opinion piece or another article, which was talking about the economic prosperity or something else, like a positive perspective. And I think it's so symptomatic of our times in the sense of like media discourses, right? Because away from, there is a certain anxiety around fixing the truth or fixing the facts. But at the same time, I don't quite know how to make sense of the fact that media publications or platforms entertain and host and platform, like provide voice to these so-called multiple perspectives and opinions, which are not false. I mean, I think that the truth and false kind of frame is perhaps not the most productive to attend to the precise kind of uncertainty that you talk about, which also marks pretty much all other topics and discourses.
Yeah, I mean, uncertainty certainly helps, in thinking about, it certainly adds a certain kind of nuance through certain forms of ambivalence. But the frustration with uncertainty for many different camps is also that there cannot be a definitive decision making when sometimes that is also somewhat required. So that's the double bind that one sort of finds oneself in. There's a lot of discussion right around deflation of expertise with respect to climate change discourse, where even amongst so much evidence, there are people who deny something like that, right? So,
absolutely. And in fact, that sort of brings me to my last question, which is, it's a two-part question. One is that I personally wanted to know, again, based on my fieldwork experiences, I feel like staying or being that media scholar who wants to answer or look at the how of how these things work out is deeply satisfying personally as an academic endeavor. But one often, if one interacts with, say, policy practitioners or others who are more interested in figuring out the so what, or like, then what did you learn? Or how do we control whatever it is, right? Those questions are harder to answer, or they require a different sort of orientation. So I was wondering if you felt that kind of pressure while you were making your way through the different case studies. Was there a certain moral ambivalence, or were you under any sort of pressure from various interlocutors to articulate your political and moral stakes in why you're interested in this?
That's a great question, right? Thanks. I didn't, wasn't writing it for policy matters, certainly, or for policy people per se. But I did talk to some policymakers also, and I also don't want to sort of be somebody who absolutely doesn't want to talk about it, because that's also construed sometimes as not taking the responsibility to it's kind of an evasion of responsibility that you don't want to talk about policy matters on this, and so it's an so So that's an important question. But then again, when I heard policy practitioners talk about certain things that they did want, right? Like they did want a definitive course of action, saying for some people, you know, that that it is important that India achieves certain electrification aims, that you know it's important that everybody has this amount of mobile phone data that they should be able to use. So in a way, one has to make cell antennas over rooftops as normal as you know, water tanks. But you do see and I think maybe this gets into me collapsing this thing that policymakers themselves become a subject of study, in the sense of how they're both frustrated sometimes with resistances to their policies, but also because they sort of seem to emphasize the utilitarian or the instrumental aspects of certain things to the extent that that I found that they became discourses of normalization. That is pretty much where my book is with respect to policy making. Yeah.
But also, like, you also spoke to a lot of grassroots community activists, organizers, other kinds of people who were also working with communities, right, to articulate their stakes and foreground and make sure that these interests were front and center. Because, again, those things really matter. So when you went and hung out with them or spoke to them, would you ever get the question as to, like, well, what are you doing here? And can we be assured that you're going to tell our story about this particular event?
Yeah. I mean, I think those questions were there as well. But since I was with them for, you know, that I would go not once, but many times, I think they understood that I was going to tell the story in quite some detail, because I wouldn't sort of just meet them once. And in many cases, I went around with them over multiple years, even trying to find out what has changed. You know, what preoccupies them now? You know, what was the state of, as you said, a kind of like rise and wane of waning of these publics? So since it was over time, I think they had that sense that I was going to tell the story in some detail.
All right. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. This was wonderful. I highly recommend everyone listening to this episode to read the book. The book packs rich ethnographic and historical detail with really insightful analysis of our media ecologies. But before we let you go, I'm sure our listeners would want to know what you're currently working on.
Right. Yeah. I'm working on a couple of different things, but I'm trying to think of the this concept which we discussed briefly around sensitivity. And kind of thinking about some of the experiments of J.C. Bose in the sort of early 1900s around plant sensitivity to millimeter waves and microwaves, and thinking of how the history of the wireless could be written through the history of these plant experiments or one part of it. So that's one of the projects I'm working on. I'm also working on a number of, because I, in a way, wrote more around documentary films related to nuclear reactors. I'm now trying to write more around fiction films, feature films on nuclear reactors, particularly this particular American film, Silkwood, this French film, Grand Central. So I'm trying to think what fictional films, in a way, bring to discourses of radiant infrastructures differently than, say documentary films. So yeah, so the Silkwood film is about Karen Silkwood, who was a labor union activist in a nuclear sort of facility, and Grand Central also really talks features these nuclear workers working in a nuclear facility, and I'm again something that we've discussed, I think, around like, you know, the how do we think about bodily exposure, how carefully they have to sort of monitor the radiation on their bodies through dosimeters, but also taking showers. And I'm still very interested in sort of bodily exposure. And I think there are new concepts that other media studies scholars and STS scholars are bringing around exposure and autonomy and questions of distribution of exposure, so on and so forth. So that preoccupies me.
Amazing. Well, I'm sure we'll read whatever you write next. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with me. Thank you.
Thanks, Nupur.